Radio St. Pete presents Typewriter Talks with Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit.
Hello, welcome to Typewriter Talks. This podcast features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. My name is Maureen McDowell, and I am the founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. On Typewriter Talks, we discuss all kinds of writerly topics, hoping to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Today, we are happy to welcome Jonathan Kyle. Jonathan has lived in St. Pete, Florida since 2001. A rare genetic condition forced him to give up a career in sales in favor of a full-time position as a father, husband, and writer. He blogs about his family travels and advocates for awareness of vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome at don'tmakemeturnthisvanaround.com. He's on the board of the literary nonprofit Keep St. Pete Lit and contributes to several local publications. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you for having me. You bring a lot of energy to this. This is, you know.
Well, that's my job, kind of.
I mean, I just have to say, we were talking just before the podcast started, and it was more on this level. And then the podcast starts. He's like, "Welcome to."
My great grandfather was a barker in a carnival. Yeah. So, come to the show.
It's in the genes.
In the genes. When it's time to be on.
That's right.
Tell us what you're working on right now.
Well, right now, I'm actually, so one of the little projects that I contribute to is called the Northeast Journal, and it's a very nice publication that comes out in my neighborhood in St. Petersburg every 2 months, and it's been around for close to 20 years, and it's one of these magazines, but it's a big tabloid size thing with like fancy ads. Yeah, it's very, you know, like
very professional,
you know, for a when you live in like one of these neighborhoods that has exploded in value, where I have no business being, we get really nice free publications in the mail, and I write for them. And the piece that I'm working on was pitched to me as being about what are the rules on AstroTurf in the neighborhood. Because AstroTurf is becoming a popular way of making your yard green without having to mow it, fertilize it, all that good stuff. And I thought, okay, this is going to be kind of a fluffy, pretty straightforward thing. But of course, it's full of controversy because AstroTurf is considered by the city of St. Petersburg and many other places to be an impermeable surface, a sidewalk or a cement pad, because AstroTurf, as much as it looks and feels and behaves like grass to us, is plastic. And also, once it gets clogged up with dirt, is as impermeable as any other hard surface for the most part. So it still causes runoff issues. It actually causes, if anybody's had kids and had been on an AstroTurf playground in the Florida sun, it is hotter than black asphalt. So AstroTurf has a lot of problems as a surface. And now I'm writing an article that, you know, if you were to go on Nextdoor, you would find it to be a very contentious topic for a newspaper that kind of avoids taking contentious material. So that's what I'm working on. And I say working on, it's a, you know, other people take to social media to rage. I have a platform for which I can present information in a way that I choose in a way. So,
but it's also like, I mean, you could really go deep with like the environmental effects. And I love that it's such a localized publication, but it really is global. This kind of, you could take it to that level really easily.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, you know, people, you could fall on two sides of any issue and you could say it's too much regulation. I should do whatever I want to do. There's that side. And there's other people who are like, you know, sea turtles and all of that stuff. And I like to take a topic like this and make it like so simple that you can't arrive at a conspiracy theory, you know, hopefully. So anyway, that's, but usually I'm writing about good things that neighbors do, teachers of the year in the neighborhood, stuff like that, you know. So, you know, it varies. And I also do a little thing every month or every issue that is like a weird plant in the neighborhood, because people have all kinds of weird stuff growing in their yards. And you know, you walk by and you go, what the heck is that? You know, so I basically take a picture of someone's plant in their yard. And if I know the person, or if I get to know the person, I'll ask them about it. I usually steal whatever I can from Wikipedia or one of those nature websites. And it's just a little, you know, couple hundred word thing. It takes me, you know, not very long to do, but it's fun. It's my way of, you know, remaining a viable part of society and being involved in the community.
But you also write for other publications too, as well.
Yes, I write a column for The Gabber, which is a news publication, a weekly, free weekly, based out of Gulfport, nearby Gulfport. Although I like to call them the Gulfport Gabber, but they go to the beaches in Pasadena and other communities. Yeah. So I think they just go by The Gabber now. They dropped the Gulfport part. And it's owned by Kathy Silvestri, who's a local writer that we know well. And she was my editor when I wrote for Creative Loafing, when I wrote something for them. My column for The Gabber is called Renaissance Dad, and it's usually, you know, kind of a humor topical thing that I write my musings, and people think it's funny, and it's kind of the voice that everybody sort of always responds to, is sort of a little bit of snark, although I try to keep it friendly, you know, kind if I can.
Balance of snark and kindness.
Well, usually the first version is like everything I'm thinking. And then the second version is one I would say out loud. my wife will read something and she'll be like, you're a little condescending here. And I'm like, well, you know, that's, you know, that's what goes through my head first.
Yeah. I like that. I wanted to interview you because you are very much a local writer. And I think that we put such emphasis on that. You have to be like, I mean, I'm sure you would love to win a Nobel Prize in literature. I mean, I would not going to say that you wouldn't, but I think it's important to see that there are ways that you can make changes and, or even just educate or even amuse people in your local community with your writing. And it doesn't have to be so broad of a spread outside of your local community. And that's why, and I don't know anyone else more than you that does just that. Cause you write, whenever I see you, cause we have a writer's group quotes around writer, because we usually are talking most of the time, Tuesday mornings, you always have a new project you're working on. Cause you have your blog too. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the blog was actually kind of sort of what, I won't say it started this, because I was writing certainly before the blog. I'd written a self-published novel and done some other things. But the blog, Don't Make Me Turn This Van Around, we had bought this Dodge Ram van, 2002 conversion van with the captain's chairs and the carpet. And, you know, it was like an old school creeper van that you named Bruce, I believe.
Yes,
and
I did.
my family was traveling around in this awesome van on a big road trip, and we decided to blog about it. You know, this was when van life was taking off, and, you know, Instagram and all that stuff. And so we thought, oh, we'll start a blog, and we called it Don't Make Me Turn This Van Around. And, you know, at the beginning, it was like this really regular thing that I spent a whole bunch of time on. I confess it has fallen into neglect and disrepair, but I did recently, I think I put something up a couple weeks ago, kind of an update, but I think before that it was several months. Kind of as my kids have gotten older, I'm a little more choosy about what I share about them, because, you know, when you're in middle school or fifth grade, yeah, as my kids are, you probably want less of your family embarrassment provided online for everybody to see. That's partially why I've been more choosy about what I put on there. Because I write the column for the Gabber, which is kind of irregular every, 4 to 6 weeks. I'm usually working on, some other kind of fun thing that I want to do. And the blog kind of ends up third because it's just, it's older. It's like the child you don't pack their lunch anymore.
What
horrible. I can't believe you just said that.
I was the oldest child, so that made me feel very warm and fuzzy.
And I'm the youngest, so I was the one that my parents were like, Mom, Dad, why are the buttons on the wrong side of the shirt you just handed me? Well, that was your sister's,
So funny. So what does a typical day for you look like as a writer?
A typical day as a writer starts with, really the typical day for me as a person is me running the kids around, because we have kids who have many activities and they're actually going back. We were homeschooling, but they're going back to school. But they're very busy people, particularly while we were homeschooling them. We signed them up for everything, which meant I was always running them around. But usually once everybody's settled into what their project is for that day, whether they're at a camp or an activity or something, I'm most effective if I have a couple things I'm working on. And by working, I mean, it's kind of like, I hate to call it work because I sort of approach it with an urgency that is, not what somebody who's like starving would maybe approach it. When I have more than one thing going, I'm more apt to be motivated to work on one of them, right? So if I'm just working on one thing, it can feel overwhelming, like, oh God, I got to kind of back into that topic again. I don't think I can do it. But if I have two things going, one of them usually suits my fancy or my mood. Like having a humor column that I write for the Gabber, which I can just write. I don't have to do any research. I don't have to interview anybody. I don't have to talk to anybody. I just like write whatever's on my mind. And if I'm inspired, if I'm feeling the energy, I can jump right in on that. If I'm not feeling like that, then I can go, okay, I need to find out about this plant that I'm researching, or I need to find out a little bit more about this charity that we're writing an article about, and I can do some research, or I can speak to a person or send off an email. So by having multiple things to do, I feel like I get more done. I feel like I'm more engaged in what I'm doing, or I enjoy it more. And then if all else fails, if I have nothing going on, I have the blog. I can, think, oh, what should I update on the blog? So that's, kind of what my day looks like. I also, because of the influence of you and the writers group, I decided to start journaling. And I started doing this on January 1st, which is nothing worse than a journal started on January 1st because, it goes for about 5 days and then you don't touch it again. But I've been pretty regular, like usually every week, sometimes 2, 3, 4 times a week, but generally even at worst once a week, I will get into my journal. And that's always nice because it's kind of like, nobody's ever going to read it. It's just my way of like, it's kind of like priming the engine, before you start it, getting the fingers going, getting the brain moving. And so, here we are nearing the end of July and that journal is still going. So that is another thing that I do. But it really just, that's what my day as a writer looks like. I also think it's important to move around. We've got a nice sunroom in the front of our house where we sit a lot, but if I'm sitting in there too much, I love coffee shops, so I'll find myself in a coffee shop. And so a change of setting is always nice. And that's actually how, these little projects kind of fall in your lap. Someone will be like, hey, you should write something for this. That's how you know, kind of house the stuff that my wife does with the, we have a kind of, she's got a partnership with I Love the Berg, which is a really big social media blog here in the Tampa Bay, St. Pete area. And what started out as, you know, some articles and some virtual historic walking tours that she does turned into a walking tour company. So I'm also kind of like my wife's research assistant when she's trying to find out about a building and she's gone down a rabbit hole and doesn't have time to spend on it. She'll say, hey, get on newspapers.com or Google and take a deep dive on this building. So I'm also, you know, kind of like my wife's research assistant when it comes to her walking tour company.
You're a great team. You're a great team.
Yeah.
So I love that idea of kind of having multiple projects going at once, because that's how I read. I have like five.
Same.
Books. Yeah. I jump. Yeah. Like I like to tend to read what the bath is filling up. It's really funny. Like I bring books and water together. It's like my rebellious spirit, but I'll bring like two books in the bathroom to like while the tub is filling up. And then it just depends on what my mood, and I might jump between two books because I'm not feeling another. And it's really, and the man that I'm dating, he's very much like, get a book, don't start another one until you finish it. Like there's this book that he wants at the bookstore, yeah. And he's really into it because we've gone into like six bookstores while we've been traveling, and
yeah,
the book. And I'm like, just buy it. And he goes, no, I'm not done with the book that I have now. But I like that idea of like jumping, and then also like changing locations. And then you know, we live in St. Pete, it's such a small town. You run into five different people in the coffee shop.
Right.
And like with my organization, so many partnerships have literally happened in like the line of coffee shops waiting to get coffee. Like,
oh, totally. Oh, I mean,
oh, we should do this.
Yeah.
And
that is really, you know, I think, you know, for me, you know, you alluded to it, or didn't allude to it. You said it in the introduction. You know, before this was my life, you know, I spent a long time in higher education fundraising. I have a degree in economics from Florida State University. I didn't really know what I was going to do with that, but I was working in fundraising at the university, and that kind of worked out into a long-term period of time where I was at University of South Florida for a while. And then I went to work for an oil distributor. That was my father-in-law's company, and I was a sales rep for 10 years. I was a very good sales rep. I was a very good oil salesman, and which is totally different from everything else in my world, being a motor oil salesman. But then when I was 42 years old, so this was 7 years ago, I had a bunch of crazy medical complications, an aneurysm, aortic dissection, open heart surgery, was diagnosed with vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and was basically medically retired at that point. And so I have sort of an unusual sort of perspective on career. I was very fortunate in my insurance coverage and those things, or, you know, who knows what would have happened to me. So I am able to sort of like take a broad look at, you know, what I do and go, what do I want to do? And I'm not going to agree to things I don't want to do. I imagine if I was trying to replace my entire sales income with writing gigs, I would be saying yes to everything, and I would be cynical about it. It is a little bit, you know, I have kind of an unusual perspective. It's a perspective that I, through some of my writing, particularly on my blog, I'm trying to impart upon people, because I don't feel like someone should have to go through a medical diagnosis and serious emergencies in order to have a perspective on life that makes you kind of approach it with the same gratitude and also with the right priorities. That was deep. Sorry.
No, I love deep. Come on. So that's a really good example of how your writing process has changed over the years. When you were a full-time salesman, did you have time to write? I know you had done your one book.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is my original idea was, as a full-time salesman, you know, I was like, you know, this was around the time that like there was a kind of this cohort of self-publishers who were like writing kind of fiction really quickly and self-publishing it and writing series. And like you make the first book free and that makes people buy the sequels. And it was this whole thing where you write like 4 or 5 books a year if you can. And you sort of build this sort of this library of books that you self-published, and you kind of generate a passive income that way. And so that was really my first book was meant really to be like the first in like this series. And that would turn into 20 books, right? And you know, maybe it would supplement my sales income, or maybe I would be able to eventually step away from sales and be a full-time writer. And what I found was after, you know, kind of I went through everything, the further I got away from that book that I wrote, which is called The Grandfather Clock, and it I think I might have just taken it down. It's been on Amazon forever, for free on Kindle. It still may be up there. I'm not sure. And it did, you know, fine. It was actually, you know, like made the sort of bestseller list very, very briefly in the Kindle books in the genre. I mean, it never made me have meaningful money, but the idea was that this would eventually be the free book and I was going to have to like have all these books, and that's how you kind of generate an income. But the further I got from that book, the less it represented what I would want to write today. It was what I was writing then. I was, you know, writing a story for someone to kind of a page turner. And I didn't want to do that anymore. And I really had just had to like, kind of like you were saying about the person you're dating, feeling like they picked up a book and they have to finish it. Like, yeah. I kind of had to let go of that attitude towards a lot of things in life. I was like, you know, I said I was going to do this thing and I was going to write all these sequels and everything, but I didn't want to do that anymore. And it's okay it's okay to set the book down. I wrote the sequel, actually. I wrote the sequel before I started having all my emergencies. I finished it actually after the fact in the editing, and it's done, but I have no desire to release it because it's not what I want to write now. It's not what I want to represent now. So, you know, for what that's worth, I think, you know, I'm the same way about reading books. I need to read. I'm reading more if I have 2 or 3 going, because then I'm in the mood to pick up this one or that one. And as opposed to like, if I'm reading just one book and it's like, oh, God, I don't want to get into that because I need to read 20 pages of that book at a time, you know, whereas other books I'll pick up and, you know, as a parent and everything, you know, you don't necessarily always have a huge amount of time in the middle of the day to read. But if you have a book that you can pick up and read 3 pages and it's no big deal because you're not going to lose your place or forget what was happening. So I always kind of have different types of books going that I'm reading. I find that I get more reading done that way. And if I don't like a book, I'll set it down. I'll read 100 pages of a book and be like, this book is not doing it for me. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to keep pursuing it.
Yeah. So,
I think as readers, particularly in our culture, reading is an assignment when you're a kid. A lot of times, you know, unless you just are born with this love of reading, which I think I have had a love of reading, but reading really was an assignment as a student. And so you never have time to read for pleasure, or you never get around to it because of, you know, TV and video games and movies and all that stuff. I felt like I had that feeling that once you pick up a book, it's really, you have to finish it. And I think that that's a problem, that people need to let go of this feeling that your book has to be finished. And if you're not enjoying it, don't keep reading it. You don't know that person anything. You already bought their book.
Yeah. Right. The guilt of the book that's sitting there staring.
Right.
Oh, yeah. God. And I've realized that I really prefer nonfiction, and I always read nonfiction growing up. And then I got into fiction for a while, and we read fiction for our book club, but I go to the bookstores. I'm always like looking in the fiction section, and I'm just like, it's just so hard to tell unless you get recommendations or whatnot. But now I've been like going directly to the nonfiction section, and I'm like buying books in droves. And it really helps to inform my poetry because I'll read something in a nonfiction book and it just like sets off my brain and immediately like poems start coming and different thoughts. So I think that's, and it's funny because I've really only come back to nonfiction and like, I would say in the last like 6 months that I've like accepted that this is, it was like this dirty little secret or something, or I felt like I should be reading more fiction or I got away from it. I don't know. But now it's like, I mean, I kind of spent most of my vacation money in the bookstores, which isn't a lot, but it's like, you know, it's, this is, that's how I blow my money is through books.
It's a good problem to have. It's a good, I think, you know, my wife is similar to you in that she's kind of like, she's always like, I'm just reading fiction lately. You know, it's really, and to a degree, I agree. Fiction is hard because nonfiction is based on, you know, what are things I'm interested in? Am I interested in history or culture or music or whatever? You can kind of go by topics, right? And memoir and that sort of thing. So it's a little easier to work the nonfiction shelves. Whereas, you know, if you're a poet or a doctor or whatever your profession is, it doesn't necessarily inform what kind of fiction you'll like, you know?
Yeah.
I've never gotten into fantasy. It just doesn't, it's not a thing for me. But people who love fantasy, I mean, are nuts about fantasy. And that's why when you go to the bookstore, there's a huge fantasy section and there's all this variety and everything is new because fantasy readers are voracious readers, right? And then the people who read the bestseller fiction might be the kind of people who only read a couple of books a year. So it's really hard to know what's good. And I'm always like disappointed when like the book that's like in the zeitgeist, you know, that's the Oprah book club that everybody's reading that year, ends up being a dud. And, what was the one we were talking? I was talking the other day and about the book, Lincoln and the Bardo. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
By George Saunders. Yeah. And this was like the thing when it came out. And I'm not saying I didn't like it, but I read a review that said, this is one of these books that you really have to listen to the audiobook because
all the Nick different voices.
Yeah. And all these different voices. And Nick Offerman was one of the main voices. And, and there was all these celebrity voices and everything. And so I got the audiobook, you know, I got it on Audible. And the thing about that book is it's kind of written in a paragraph and then it'll say who's speaking. And so it's like kind of in this disjointed narrative. I say disjointed and it's a negative, but when you're reading it on the page, it kind of works because your eye kind of skips and says, okay, who's talking right now? Okay, this person's talking, even though you're just reading it. But in the audiobook, you have no idea who's talking for a page or two. And then it tells you, and you're like, well, now I got to rewind my brain, you know? So I kind of like muddled through and I got like halfway through it. I'm like, I don't like this book. I'm going to just admit that I don't like this book. Do I have to read it? And then enough people were like, it's brilliant. I can't believe you don't like this book. And I went back and I did finish it. It did kind of pick up for me, but you know, I'm always like, you know, I wasn't running around recommending that book to people. They're just me, you know?
Yeah. I think it was just the part, he just had a different narrative style than everybody was used to reading. I think it was the novel. Not that it's a bad book at all, but I think that was like, I don't think about that book. Like some books like haunt me,
right.
But I think it was a new narrative style and people were craving a new narrative style, especially the way that publishing has changed so much where if you don't have like something that knocks everyone's socks out of, you know, everybody buys it, then you lose your, you know, agent.
It
becomes so capitalistically funded. Not funded, but it may be capitalist. Yeah, that's probably, and driven is the word I would say. So
yeah,
I think that's why a lot of the smaller presses are really still hopefully holding on to that like integrity, and that you can find an author and really just like love them. But it just depends. I think that's what's so great about reading is it depends on your taste. Like there's something for everybody.
Well, and that's true. And I think the difficult thing, you know, obviously publishing is a victim of it, it's a product of capitalism, but it's also a victim of capitalism, because when you used to have the big publishers willing to take a chance on up and coming writers, really now the investment is in the established writers. And I think they're, sometimes I think, are people all just pretending to like this book? You know, it's like, is no one willing to admit that it wasn't good because they've thrown all this money behind it, or there's going to be a movie or whatever? But I think that, there's also like this sort of feeling that you can't take a chance on a new writer. But the smaller publishers are doing that. If I'm breaking up on you, it's because someone's trying to call me right now. And, but I think if you do find those smaller publishing places, or you're just as likely to find a great book there now, which is also good. The unfortunate thing for writers is nowadays, no one's getting these huge signing bonuses. You know, as a new writer, you have to have your audience already. You have to have a gigantic emailing list with hundreds of thousands of emails and a following already.
You have to have a blog. All introverts. It feels like hell to me.
And it's like they won't even talk to you unless you're already famous, you know. So a lot of those people who got those big signing bonuses and the book didn't become a bestseller and they just faded off into obscurity. You know, maybe they're successful self-publishers now. Maybe they've got a small press. Maybe they're editors.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably just as many people making money as writers. It's just the distribution is a little bit different.
And I also think there are some people that go the big route and then they're like, wait, this isn't really worked for me as much.
So totally.
I think that the core thing is like, do you love to write? And both of us love to write, because I know for me personally, there's been 1,000 other things I could have done, and there's 1,000 different distractions in this world, but we still want to go back to the page. And that is the root of what it means to be a writer. All this other stuff is just distraction and noise that you have to navigate.
Yeah.
Well, I love your story. Yeah. I love your story too. I mean, I don't love that you have a rare genetic condition, but I love the fact that you started out one way as a writer and now you've found another way that I think it has more depth. You're a person of immense depth, which is why we're friends.
It's a prerequisite.
Well, it is a prerequisite for me anyway, because there's plenty of other things you could do other than talk to somebody that's not interesting.
Well, that is the truth, because like when I first was diagnosed, and I was, I had a series of hospitalizations, and there was a stay-at-home dad that lived down the street from me, and he was a psychiatrist or psychologist, and he said to me one day, well, he was a stay-at-home dad psychologist, and he said, this is going to get hard. You're going to like have this sort of like crisis of, purpose in life, as a stay-at-home dad. And I was like, okay, I was like kind of hearing him out, I think I was still on a lot of painkillers and stuff at the time. So everything was just kind of information at that point. And, the funny thing was, I never went through this crisis that he spoke of, but I do feel like writing was always sort of therapeutic. And that for me, it gives my kids something to say. Well, what does your dad do? He's a writer, they don't have, someone doesn't have to explain, like it'd be one thing, my dad, he doesn't work, he's a stay-at-home dad or whatever, they can identify their dad as a writer. And they see me, writing, so that's what they see as my, sort of identity, the thing that makes me not just a dad or a husband or a guy who drives them around in the car,
Not that there's anything wrong with just being
not that the, no, yeah. not, but I think, obviously, like I
you want to have like meaning and purpose besides.
I'm being. Almost like the 50s housewife, who says this is a lot harder than you think it is. And I need my own outlets, right? But yeah. So I had to get away from the kind of writing that I didn't want to do in my new circumstance. And so that's, you know, kind of where I landed. And it is therapeutic and enjoyable. And it has made me a thinker and probably way more depth than I did before. I was probably, you know, far more superficial before. And, you know, it's arrogant enough to think that I'm a deep person myself. You know, I have to let other people say that about me. So,
no, you always had depth, John. You
know, I'm sure.
A little bit with a sprinkle of superficial, but you've always had depth.
Do you want to talk about the Real Housewives of what I'm?
I mean, some of the things
some
of the things I threw your way, you know, when you first met me, and that you didn't run screaming, shows that you have
depth. Yeah, that's true. Well, it's funny because I am willing. I'm more willing. Has this person to intake people's inner idiosyncrasies, and I'm not talking specifically about you or when we met, but when I meet somebody who maybe turns me off or is a little odd, I go, let me give that person a little bit of a chance, see what makes them this way, right? Because maybe there's something there, something more there. Maybe there's a reason that they are, you know, so unusual. Because it's really, once you get to, it's the unusual people that are interesting, right? I mean,
yeah.
So it's like, you know, I haven't seen it, but it's like, you know, what I imagine of what everything I hear about the Barbie movie, you know, and like sort of the, you know, the superficial things in life and you know, social hierarchies and all that kind of stuff and gender and, you know, it's a crazy world we live in. And if you're not processing it and you're just ignoring it, you're probably coping some way that's unhealthy. That's a whole other topic, right?
And the two of us keep talking for another 3 hours. I know this.
Right.
But I also know that you have to go pick up your child.
This is true.
You also can't talk for a long period of time or your voice will start to bother you. Let's hear a piece of your writing.
Oh, that's right. I forgot I was going to read a piece of my writing. So this is going to be my column for the Gabber is kind of parenting and humor observation. And I'm going to read something that I don't even really remember what I wrote. So I'm going to read it to you, but this is Renaissance Dad for the Gabber.com. And it's called Bitcoins and Beanie Babies. A while back, Gulfport became famous for being the home of the first home sale conducted via cryptocurrency. As I sit down to write this, I've watched several short videos aimed at helping my young children understand crypto. I'd like to say that it's part of our homeschooling curriculum, but sadly, because I've read dozens and dozens of articles explaining Bitcoin, and I still don't really understand it. I only have a degree in economics, so understandable that this might be hard for me. Oh, I get that it's decentralized money. And I know that there are warehouses full of computers in rural America mining Bitcoin by solving math problems and using so much electricity that lakes are boiling. What the computers are doing cannot be explained in the English language. I understand that it's completely anonymous, impossible to steal, and apparently quite easy to lose. There's a guy in Scotland who threw out an old laptop, forgetting that he'd once mined some then worthless Bitcoin. Today's worth about $150 million. Now he's literally trying to get the municipality to let him mine the dump for his lost Bitcoin. Pretty sure I can't get a cent for solving the daily Wordle. I've had long conversations with a local cryptocurrency guru, you know who I'm talking about, Maureen, in which we both leave frustrated. He says, people agree Bitcoin has value, and that's why it has value. I said, it sounds like Beanie Babies, harkening to the day when specific stuffed toys were supposedly in demand and more valuable. He conceded, yes, it's like Beanie Babies, but it's not going to go away. And just as soon as I accepted the fact that my kids are going to handle my Bitcoin investment for me, the crypto nerds started talking about NFTs. I went to an article explaining NFTs for beginners, and it said, this is a quote, non-fungible tokens are digital assets that contain identifying information recorded in smart contracts. Oh, why didn't you just say so? digital assets, smart contracts. It's like the emperor's new clothes. And we're all just nodding our heads at this stuff, except people are getting rich and poor and rich and poor again. And I'm missing the roller coaster ride. As I understand it, NFTs are a digital way to assign ownership to some asset, usually but not only, always digital. Like, I could send you a PDF of this issue of the Gabber with an NFT, and you'd have the original digital issue, as original as the Mona Lisa. All other PDFs of the Gabber would be like posters from the Louvre Museum gift shop. Why am I even writing about this? I could say that, as a parent, it's important for us to teach our kids financial literacy. But I resent that the only path to getting Bitcoin, other than buying it like a dumb investor, is to have giant computers solving complicated math problems. I've written about plants, and people have emailed and offered me plants. I've written stories about peanuts, and readers have offered me peanuts. I've written about brick pavers, and yes, I've been offered brick pavers. So now I'm relying on the computing power of my fingers and my laptop for someone to give me one measly Bitcoin. Sure, it's worth $21,000, but that can't last. I promise not to lose it.
Oh, I love it. I love how your brain works.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. I think you have a wonderful holistic way of like touching all these different points about what it means to be a human in this world today. So thank you for that. And I love you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here on Typewriter Talks. And thank you everyone for listening. We will be back next week with another writer. And I love this conversation, John, because we kind of went all over the place about what it means to be a writer and a reader and a human. And this is why this podcast is always so nourishing for me. So thank you. And all of you that tune in and listen, we appreciate you too. I mean, yes, John and I could sit in a cafe and or record this podcast and talk for hours, and it doesn't really matter if people listen, but we are glad you are listening. And if you want to know more about Keep St. Pete Lit, you can go to keepstpetelit.org. And if you do like what you hear, please consider donating, because we are a nonprofit, and that would help keep this programming going. So until next week, please continue to read and write on.
Typewriter Talks features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. It is hosted by Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. Listen in to hear discussions on all kinds of writerly topics. Our goal is to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Learn more about Keep St. Pete Lit at www.keepstpetelit.org.